Jeremiah tonight, chapter 2. We've had a little bit of a break, but I'm really glad to return to our study. This is just such a wonderful book, and I hope that tonight's message is encouraging to you as it has been for me and just in my own studies. We're right in the middle of chapter 2, so when we were here a few weeks ago, we did that first chunk, the first 8 verses. When we were last in our study, you know, we of course remember that they're in exile. That's the whole background to the story, and they're coming back to the land of promise. And the way that God is working this out is Nehemiah is given this very honored, privileged position to be the cupbearer to the king in Persia, really the most powerful king in the world at the time, very likely. I think we could say that. And so God providentially positions him for this important task. And as we see this, we should, and this is going to continue throughout the book, but we'll see it tonight certainly, that we should see God's grace in this, a sign of God's restoring grace, that rather than leaving them in exile, rather than leaving Jerusalem in ruins, rather than leaving things as they were, God is gracious and has a restoring purpose for this. And we see this all throughout the Bible, don't we? Our God is a God who restores. And so, using the resources of the Persian Empire, the empire that really, in a sense, is dominating the people of God and oppressing them in some circumstances, God is going to use all those resources to send Nehemiah back to Jerusalem to begin restoring the society. That's sort of a spoiler alert there, but that's ultimately what this is going to be. This is going to be beginning of the work that God's going to do, and really just the beginning of the work that's going to be done in Jerusalem. Of course, we know Ezra, about 13 years before, has some work there, but really, in earnest, this is where it's going to begin. And so let's read it together, Nehemiah chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. Nehemiah 2, 9. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen, sort of the king's escort as he's going. But when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah the Ammonite, servant, heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. At this point, he's keeping it private, what God has put on his heart. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up by night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered the valley gate, and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Verse 17. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned? Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab, a new person added there, heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, this is their words, "What is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." So this is how the story is unfolding here. In verses 9 and 10, going back to the top of our passage here, we see it's by the hand of God, and we must see it's by the hand of God, that Nehemiah is setting out with really incredible royal authorization. He's not just sort of let go and the king says, "Yeah, go do your thing. I hope it goes well for you," but truly being sent out. Back in verse 8, we saw this several weeks ago, but if you just kind of glance up there, Nehemiah recognized that it was the Lord's hand that was upon him. God's blessing is really unmistakable in all this. Again, not only is he cupbearer, Not only is he cupbearer at a certain time and to a certain king, but he's sent again with all this legitimacy and protection. The king sends him out with letters, if you remember. He gives him all this list. Would you send me with letters so that everyone knows that you sent me here and they don't try to imprison me or kill me? Would you make sure you send me with an escort and with these resources? Do you assume that money is involved here? This was a long and arduous journey. The king's bankrolling all of it. It's incredible. God's blessing. And now you might think, okay, with all of this in order, I mean, by God's grace, Nehemiah has all this stuff. I bet that would remove all the potential obstacles. Everything's going to go smoothly. But of course, you'd be wrong. That's not at all what happens. He really faces challenges right from the start, doesn't he? And we see they become very, very stark challenges here in just a little bit. And we'll talk more about that later in terms of some of the details because it's at the end of the passage here. But it's sort of foreshadowing. We see in verses 10, ultimately is foreshadowing what we're going to see at the end of the passage. But Nehemiah expects all of this. So as much as we see God's blessing in this, we also see that Nehemiah is a very wise man. So he's made some preparation for this. He's prepared even in his own heart to deal with some of this opposition. And so that's why he's careful to ask for all these very specific provisions from the king. And so these men who oppose Nehemiah in verse 10, they're local rulers. And we see the first two named, and they're basically geographically boxing in around Judah. So we have someone up in Galilee, we have someone over to the east, Ammonite, and then we have one in closer to Arabia that's going to be named later in verse 19. And so basically all of the kings and the kingdoms around, all the rulers around the kingdom of Judah are sort of going to be circling in and trying to oppose what Nehemiah is doing. And we'll speak more about why that is here in a little while. Actually, this would be a good place to talk about it. So let me just throw it out to you. Why, if you had to guess, okay, so I've already given some of the political ramifications, why would they oppose what Nehemiah is doing? Any guesses? I mean, it's not just that they're like, oh, we're not so crazy about that, but they're clearly going to oppose him. Bob, why do you think they would oppose him? Yeah.
And they were probably filching taxes and things.
So there's some financial incentive, right?
It was going to hurt them to have that wall back up.
Yeah. So some financial reasons. Money talks, right? I mean, a lot of, you know, money moves things, right? I mean, we know that's the way of the world. What else? Yeah. That's going to be a really key theme as we go through the book of Nehemiah. You go out to seek to be obedient to God, and there's all this opposition. You're like, what in the world? Aren't I obeying you, God? And yet, it's a theme, isn't it? There's one more thing that I think is pretty important here, and it's just religious, that they do not believe in the same God. They are not Jews. So they would have different religious beliefs, and so they do not appreciate the Jews coming back. You know, they would have been polytheistic, or at the very least in Samaria and Galilee, they would have had an opposing form of monotheism. One of these guys is from Samaria. And so there's even religious friction here. We can think about jealousy and the financial thing, but I think certainly we need to think about that. They did not follow Yahweh, the one true God. And so they are going to oppose his work. That's very often we see sowed by the adversary. In verses 11 through 16, kind of this middle chunk here, Nehemiah seemed to, he's going to set out ultimately to see the state of things, right? What is he actually dealing with? He's heard reports about what the walls look like. He has some secondhand knowledge, but he's going to go out for himself. But before he does that, notice in verse, is it 11? He says he waits there for 3 days. Why does he note this? You know, why add this note in here? Why, do you have any guess on why he would include this? Why the important thing? Why does he wait for 3 days? If he's so eager, why not get out there on day one? We have a couple, Miss Audrey. Oh, okay. So discerning in that. That's good. That's a good thought. David, were you going to say something? Yeah. Taking that time. And that would be similar, right? Taking that time to discern. He's a wise man, clearly. We saw that earlier in chapter 1, right? Where, you know, before he answers the king, he goes and prays about it, right? And so there's this wise, you know, posture of taking things to the Lord. Sort of the expression that's often used of men or women like that is they have calloused knees, right? They're going to go to the Lord just out of habit. I think that could certainly be a big part of it. But there's another one I think that's in the text here. He needed to rest. You know, he's exhausted. I mean, we hear this when we forget that, but he traveled about 1,000 miles, okay? Not by airplane, okay? Not by a train. Now, he had an animal, so that's helpful. Okay, because the king sent him out. At least he's on an animal, but that's a long way. Depending on the route you would take, it could be anywhere from about 850 to about 1,000 miles, historians tell us. There's just little themes in here. But again, he's wise enough to know he needed to catch his breath. He's exhausted. And I think there probably is the discernment, probably. I think we could see that suggested as well. The principle of rest is a really important biblical principle. Just think of the Ten Commandments, right? The Sabbath. The first thing God does in building into creation is making a day of rest, right? Written into even as a creation ordinance. And so it's just good for us to pause and think about that. We think about all of the spiritual things, but there's practical things too. He went out by night. He's sneaking out to inspect the walls. We need to see that, again, he's given great thought to all this. He's a careful, calculated man. Not in a sneaky way, but just using prudence, right? He makes his case to the people that he needs a realistic picture ultimately if he's going to be able to make that case. What is he really up against here? Now, I wasn't going to go into a whole lot of background. Do we remember why walls are so important? I mean, we don't have walls in Asheville, right? Nobody's worried. But what was the issue with walls in the ancient world? Bandits? No, that's okay. It's fine. Just safety in general, right? So it could be a few bandits. It could also be a rival kingdom. It could be one of these guys that are, you know, nervous about the walls going up. It's like, why are you so nervous about these walls? Is it because you want to come ultimately dominate us in this way? And so it was just fundamental safety. I mean, you could not have an ancient city of any sort other than if you're like a nomadic tribe, it's fine. You could just sort of move on. But if you have a real, you know, a substantial civilization, you had to have walls to really function. They're living basically in ruins of Jerusalem. And so this was just fundamental stuff. And so Bob's absolutely right in terms of the safety. And just of all forms of safety, they need these walls. By the way, just a little historical nugget. This will actually answer both why and when. When did they stop building walls for cities? Anybody know? It was in the Middle Ages. The invention of gunpowder. Walls don't stand up to cannons. So with the inventions of gunpowder, you can actually track, you know, 1300s or so, depending where you are. Of course, it's invented in China and Asia and eventually makes its way to Europe. But in Europe, they quit building cities with walls with the invention of gunpowder. It was no longer necessary. In fact, it could actually be an obstacle because now you're stuck underneath all the rubble. Anyway, just an interesting little nugget there. So as we move forward here into verse 12, he hasn't shared yet what God has put on his heart. And it's an interesting expression here, what God has put on his heart. We say that, don't we? We use that term. We know what that means, right? It's not as if God spoke to him in sort of an auditory way. It's not as if God wrote something, but just sort of an impression, right? God giving him this impression, putting something on his heart. Now maybe that sounds like something that charismatics would say, or like Pentecostal, or I got a word for you, brother. But really, I mean, this is biblical language. God puts something on his heart, and he feels strongly enough that he's putting his life at risk. He's going through all this. So it's not merely a sort of an impulse. He's not an impulsive man. We know that Nehemiah is a wise man, and yet he's able to say this is something God has put on his heart. It's very interesting. In verses 17 and 18, Nehemiah cast a vision to them. He's going to finally reveal what God has said to him, and this is his chance. He's going to make his case, he's going to cast this vision, and we're going to see what happens ultimately. He shared what really God has been doing. He's not just going to give the immediate point. He's saying, by the way, look at what God has already done. Kind of looking back to what we saw in chapter 1, he says that everything that God had spoken through the king and done through the king and so on. And so in verse 18, what do? They say, let's do it. We're with you. They say, amen. And in fact, that's what amen means. It means, let it be so. Amen. Let's do it. It says, it's interesting the way this is a biblical sort of a Hebraism. They strengthen their hands for the good works. Meaning, they're preparing themselves. We're game. Let's do it. And there's no way Nehemiah could have done this on his own, right? No matter how great of a leader he might be, no matter how spirit-filled, you know, he is, you know, he's one man. And so but these people rally together and say, we're with you, let's do it. But almost immediately, this is going back to what Leon said earlier in verse 19, almost immediately they face opposition. And it, on one hand, it sort of vindicates Nehemiah that he wasn't paranoid, right? Why is he taking all this, you know, all these precautions and he's sneaking out at night? Because he knew. He knew the kind of opposition that he would face. He'd expected it. He has a good sense of prescience and forethought. And that's exactly what happens. Enemies are sort of climbing out of the woodwork, right? And this happens often to us, that God would put something on our heart, or God would lead us to do something, and we face challenges. So many ways. Again, not only in sort of big things, building walls, but maybe God puts it on someone's heart to adopt a child, and it turns out to be a very trialsome affair. Maybe God puts on your heart financially to help someone, and yet you're worried. I don't know, you know, financially, you know, how I'm going to make all this do. And so that there's fear involved in there, and there's risk, right? We think about all the things that we might be led to do as a church, or that you might be led to do individually. Big things and small things. We can expect to face opposition. And very often, it is when God is actually at work doing something that the adversary is most going to rage against it, right? I mean, if the adversary doesn't care what you're doing, why is he's not going to oppose you? But it's when God has called us to do something that very often the adversary is lurking and trying to attack. Don't be surprised when this happens to you or to our church, to your family, whatever it would be, as we seek to follow after God. And so I've often said this, even when I've talked to people in sort of a counseling way, that just because you're facing a trial in trying to be obedient doesn't mean you should stop being obedient. Very often what it means is you need to have the sort of resolve that Nehemiah has to push forward, confidence. And so as we think about this, how could we sort of add some vocabulary to the sort of opposition that he's facing? What would you use to describe the way that these men are opposing Nehemiah and his work? What are they doing? Yeah. So sort of slander, right? I mean, in this could put him in jail. This could have his head, you know, I mean, in a basket, right? So yeah, so they're sort of accusing him, and ultimately we're going to see more of this coming up, right? And in a really severe way. I think we could say ridicule, right? Just, well, who do you think you are? What are you doing? What did you come all the way here for? Get back to Persia. So ridicule, threatening, slander, I think those are good words. Anything else? Discouragement, right? Right. Ridicule takes its effect by sort of defeating us, right? Wearing us down. I guess maybe I'm not able. I guess maybe I'm not equipped. Or maybe God hasn't called me, right? Bob.
They no doubt thought that Artaxerxes was on their side. Mm. And now all of a sudden, that's out the window. That's shaken, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which side are you on, right? Yeah. Yeah.
And captured British shipping. Mm-hmm. Our ship, the Enterprise, comes from that line. Mm-hmm. And in the end, when the war was over, the privateers became pirates.
Yeah.
They had to go back to what they knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of a sudden, the side shifted. I think maybe the bandit situation could have been.
Think about that. In fact, that's a great point Bob's bringing. Bob's got a good deep voice. Hopefully most of you can hear that. Think about just the way that, okay, Nehemiah has just laid out his plan. He's just laid all these things out, and they're like, yeah, we're with you. And now they're hearing all this. They're hearing slander. They're hearing accusations. They're hearing ridicule. I mean, think how easy it would be for some of them to go, yeah, maybe that was premature. Maybe we don't need to do this. Or they realize, oh, these guys are actually scary. I'm with you, Nehemiah, but not at my life, you know, not putting my life on the line. And so it was a way to demoralize, right, those who were going to come up and those who were going to do this work. And it's amazing how powerful words are. No violence, right? Not yet. No assault, right? It's really just words. And yet words are very powerful. We should never underestimate the power of words. A lot that we could think about there, but it'll keep coming up because this opposition, now you go through Ezra and you see it there too. Now we're going to see it in Nehemiah as well. This is just, again, back to Leon's part, this is part of what happens. Did Jesus not face opposition? You better believe he did. All throughout his ministry. Elijah and Elisha, I mean, we could go all the way through the Old Testament as well, right? So verse 20, Nehemiah faces these challenges with just incredible boldness in the Lord. And he's determined to do what God has put on his heart. One commentator calls it a holy stubbornness, right? Stubbornness can be a good thing. Someone actually encouraged Joy and I one time in this. Our daughter is very, we try to find other words. She's very strong-willed. If you're strong-willed about the right things, that's a strength. Now, if it's about not eating your dinner, that's when it becomes harder, right? But if we're stubborn about the right things, that's a good thing, right? If we're stubborn about holding on to sound doctrine, if we're stubborn about following what God has told us in terms of our personal holiness, that's a good thing to be stubborn about. And so I like that, holy stubbornness. We have to keep the adjective there, but a holy stubbornness is good. So we see just Nehemiah's extraordinary faith in this, and that's going to be the story throughout the book, and we're going to see it unfolded in different ways. And yet not merely, again, sort of a stubbornness without wisdom. There's great wisdom, discretion and prudence, and really hard work, right? It could be easy for him to say, you know, hey, the king's got all this taken care of. You know, I can sort of just come through this and not worry about this. But he's very thoughtful, he's careful, and Nehemiah is going to show a great work ethic as well. So we'll end there tonight. We're at our time. And God willing, next week we'll return and go into chapter 3. But any final thoughts about that before we close in prayer? We've already got to discuss a few things. Any final thoughts or questions? Okay. All right. Don, would you mind closing us in prayer tonight? Okay. Don's going to close us in prayer.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I'll go ahead. Okay. David, would you mind? I'll just work my way back. Thank you, David.